Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is Dan Friedel in for VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. We have two primary topics for you today on this hump day edition of the show, women's soccer and the NBA awards. But first, this note on the African Cup of Nations, which is now into the second set of games in the group phase after Cameroon defeated Guinea-Bissau 2-0 and Ghana and Benin tied with two goals apiece on Tuesday. Wednesday's early game saw Nigeria defeat Guinea, and in just a few minutes, Uganda plays Zimbabwe before the match day concludes with Egypt facing the Democratic Republic of Congo. The big news out of the Egyptian camp is the suspension of Amir Warda, who was one of the Pharaoh's first subs in the opening win over Zimbabwe. Warda, according to reports, has been disciplined due to inappropriate social media behavior. Let's move on now to the Women's World Cup, whose quarterfinal pairings are set after Italy's 2-0 win over China and the Netherlands' 2-1 win over Japan on Tuesday. Kwabena Quicksilver Ofori is here now to get us up to date. Sporty greetings, Kwabena.
The quarterfinal stage of the ongoing FIFA Women's World Cup in France is set with 7 European teams and United States qualified. The 4 matches will be held between June 27 and 29 when host country France will meet defending champions USA at Parc des Princes in Paris. In the other fixtures, Norway will face England at Stade Océan in Le Havre. Italy and Netherlands will be in contention at Stade de Hano in Valenciennes. And Germany will play Sweden at Rosen Park in Rennes. As part of FIFA's commitment to promote and eradicate all forms of discrimination from football, the pre-match protocol of the quarterfinal matches will include a call to action from the captains of the 8 participating teams to encourage fans to unite against all forms of discrimination and celebrate inclusion irrespective of ethnic origin, gender, sexual orientation, disability, religion, or any other reason. Meanwhile, Netherlands fans are ready to cheer their orange team to victory at their favorite Valenciennes venue, which is about an hour drive from the Netherlands, as they supported in their group stage match against the indomitable Lioness of Cameroon. For the Sunny Side of Sports, Cameroon 4 in Paris, France.
Thank you, Kwabena. I'm Dan Friedel in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Here now is Iron Mike Mbonye, who spoke with Emmanuel Okara, a sports editor at the News Agency of Nigeria. Mike and Emmanuel talked about the performance of the women's teams from Nigeria and Cameroon, who were both eliminated over the weekend in the round of 16. Welcome, Mike and Emmanuel.
For the fact that they've crashed out of the competition at this stage, I would say it was not an inspiring performance as such, because other countries that are still there are countries that qualified for this World Cup like them with the ambition of possibly going beyond this round and maybe one of them will eventually win. But unfortunately for us, our teams crashed when it mattered most. And as such, I would not say I was impressed with the way they performed at the tournament.
Two of the teams that represented Africa, Nigeria, Cameroon, had issues with decisions or calls made by the referee, referring to the video assistant referee. Cameroon, at a point in their match against England, tried to stage a walkout. Nigeria, too, protested about some penalties that were awarded against them. What's your take on this VAR used by FIFA for this Women's World Cup? And the effect it had on the African teams?
For now, the VAR might be causing controversies here and there, and I'll describe it as a teething stage, so to speak. But it's something that has come to stay. And by the time we get it right with the way what they see is interpreted, teams will start adjusting. Now, on the reaction of the two teams, Nigeria and Cameroon. Yeah, I watched the match. Nigeria versus France. That was the only goal France used to defeat us. The goalkeeper should have stayed and not moved beyond the line. So the way it is, even though we consider that goal, which eventually led, in short, kept us in suspense because we were still waiting for results from other places to determine our fate, our girls still went on and played. We protested, but I wish, or they ought to have known, that there are certain rules and regulations. And I blame our officials if they had not instilled this to the girls to say, look, oh, these are things, these are do's and don'ts in this World Cup. In the case of the Cameroonians, they completely lost focus. They were unprofessional. After all, Diego Maradona used his hand to score in 1986 World Cup against England. The English players continued the match. They did not stage a walkout. You first of all have to obey the referee's decision because it's fine that all those their walkout or the tantrums they threw and so on were not necessary. They were not professional enough. Agreed, it's a painful decision, but you have to continue. That's how it's supposed to be done.
Do you think that the Confederation of African Football, CAF, should introduce the use of the VAR for major CAF tournaments in the continent?
We just have to catch up with the rest of the world. Currently, every part of the world, they wear football boots to play football. They wear jerseys to play football. And when new rules and regulations are introduced, we also adopt it. So there is no way we will not eventually adapt VAR. Maybe some countries might not have the wherewithal, the means to, but it is inevitable. It has come to stay. And we just have to start getting used to it. And so that, and one beauty about VAR helps to detect offenses that are committed off the ball incidents and so on. Yeah, there are times when it favors you, you would be happy, but when it goes against you, there'll be complaint. Typical with human nature. There's nothing that comes that will satisfy everybody. People will protest, but you just have to accept it because it's part of the rules and regulations of the game.
The farthest an African team has gone in the Women's World Cup was in 1999 to the quarterfinal stage, and that was Nigeria. Ever since, no African team has made it beyond the round of 16. Looking forward, looking ahead, what do you think the Confederation of African Football should do? And then the various teams in Africa that are into female football, what should they do to go beyond the round of 16 and even get to the semi-finals of the FIFA Women's World Cup?
I think for starters, we should strengthen Women's Football League domestically and continentally so that by so doing, it will sharpen the competitive edge of our players. Then those that are good enough to play professional football in countries that have the infrastructure and all the necessary wherewithal to boost the morale, the confidence, the skill of these players, they should go. Then the training, the kind of training we expose our players to, the kind of competitions, all those things helped. That mainly these things are psychological. Focus. Having the skill is one thing. Then the organization, how the players play. Because I watched some of our matches, there's still a wide gulf between us and countries like Germany, Sweden, United States, France, Japan. These are countries that we even started before them. 1991, when the first World Cup was held in China, if I'm not mistaken, Nigeria was there. And we did well. And we've been having a bit. Unfortunately, it's at least there's a mental block. We just have to go beyond that mental block. The moment we get beyond that mental block, I assure you, we'll go places.
Thank you, Mike and Emmanuel. I'm Dan Friedel in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. We're joined now by Lindsay Gibbs, a sports writer for Think Progress, based here in Washington, D.C. Lindsay's been following the Women's World Cup and recently wrote a story about what she called, and I quote from her story, "the racist stereotypes so many in the media cling to when discussing female football players from African countries, both on the field and off." It's a thought-provoking story that's worth checking out. Lindsay, thanks for joining us on The Sunny Side of Sports.
Thanks so much for having me.
So a lot of the conversation in the Women's World Cup so far has been about the difference in caliber of the teams that have been playing kind of in the lower half of the Women's World Cup rankings. You know, the sense that some of the teams that have been struggling in the past have been a little bit more successful this year. We've seen that with South Africa getting into the tournament for the first time. We see the team from Cameroon and the team from Nigeria getting into the elimination phase of the tournament. What have you thought of the tournament so far as we head into the second knockout phase?
Yeah, I think it's been an incredibly competitive and enthralling tournament. Of course, during the group stages, there were some blowouts and some non-competitive games. But look, that happens in the Men's World Cup too. That's going to happen anytime you have, you know, such a variety of teams playing, you know, in these knockout rounds. But once these round of 16 matches began, the knockout stages, it's just been, there have been so many nail biters. And it's been, yeah, it's been really thrilling to see teams like Spain and Italy really showing up and performing well on this stage. Of course, we've seen, you know, to see two African teams make it to the knockout rounds was really, you know, historic, the performances of both Cameroon and Nigeria. And, you know, to see teams like South Africa, but then also, you know, Jamaica made it here, Chile, Argentina. You know, you're seeing a lot of teams that are, you know, that have not been invested in well, that, you know, we haven't seen their federations giving them a lot of support. But these women have been able to fight and get themselves into this world stage anyways. And that's been really, I've just loved every second of it.
Well, so have a lot of fans who've been watching these games in the U.S. and around the world. For our audience in Africa, they may not have any sense of the way the African teams are being covered by the North American media, the Northern European media. So I thought it was interesting the way your story described some of the ways that the team from Cameroon and the team from Nigeria were being described in the British newspapers, for example, following the England win over Cameroon, and some of the way the commentators were talking about the players from Nigeria during the match against Germany. When you were watching those games, what was your reaction to those conversations that were going on, kind of the overtones of the game beyond actually what was happening on the playing field?
Yeah, I thought overall the conversations were very reductive and, you know, were rooted, you know, in some stereotypes, some racist stereotypes that, you know, persist to this day. It's something I notice, you know, often anytime, you know, you're watching how the media is talking about black athletes, even in the United States. But it was even more stark seeing how the you know, the Western media, the British media, and the United States broadcasters were talking about these African teams. For Nigeria, for instance, the Fox Sports broadcasters, that's where we're watching it, is on Fox Sports. They pretty explicitly talked about, you know, Thomas Dennerby, the white European head coach, coming over and kind of, I mean, taming is the type of rhetoric they were using. You know, the wild skill of the Nigerians. I think the exact quote was, Nigeria kept making it into the World Cup based on their athleticism, and finally, with Dennerby, they're getting a proper coach to teach them proper tactical and technical aspects to their game. And I just thought that was just, you know, I mean, it not only did I feel like it short-sighted the intelligence and the skill of the Nigerian players as a whole, but look, I mean, it was hard not to associate that with, you know, some, you know, colonial rhetoric that we're using here. So that was really disappointing. You know, something a lot of us notice is, you know, when you see teams like this, you know, they teams from Africa, they're constantly talked about with pace and power, pace and power. And it's not to say that anytime you say pace and power that that's, you know, racist or a stereotype. Teams do have pace and power. But the point is that with African teams, the conversation often starts and finishes there, and that's dismissive and usually incorrect. There's much more to World Cup teams than just pace and power, any World Cup team.
I'm Dan Friedel, filling in for Sonny Young on the Sunny Side of Sports here in Washington, D.C. on the Voice of America. We're talking with Lindsay Gibbs, a sports reporter for Think Progress, about the way the African women's soccer teams have been portrayed by the Western media during this Women's World Cup going on in France. So, Lindsay, you just mentioned the fact that, you know, you can't get into the elimination stage of a World Cup without having a tactically strong team and beyond just this sort of raw ability. Why do you think that there are this, why do you think there is this kind of conversation, consistently going on when the teams that are mostly white players are playing against the teams from Africa?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's these stereotypes based in racism that persist. And like I said, I see this often, you know, in, you know, this is with United States teams, you know, we'll talk about black athletes as their raw athleticism a lot. And then, you know, with white athletes, it's their grit and their intelligence and, you know, that they're just a smart football player. When, you know, often, I mean, the answer is for all elite athletes is that it's a combination of both, right? Like there's no, and so I think that's what's frustrating. And, you know, but it was really stark, this conversation, the Cameroon match against England. Of course, the British press is always very outspoken and always very dramatic. But, you know, I mean, look, Cameroon fell apart a little bit during the match. There were definitely some unsportsmanlike things that the Cameroon team did. And I think it's absolutely right to point out that there were some questionable, you know, actions when it came to, you know, some of the elbows or, you know, the hits, or even, you know, there was a spitting incident, which I think, you know, some said was incidental, but, you know, anyways, it wasn't great. But also I saw the pearl clutching by the media and by Phil Neville, the coach for Cameroon, was pretty stark. I mean, you know, we're talking about, you know, this front page of SunSport with the name, you know, Cameroons, and shaming the game is the front page of another, you know, tabloid. And it was really, the way it was being talked about was like this African team has sullied our beautiful game. And that was the overwhelming takeaway from so many of these conversations, including from the England coach himself. And so that really stood out to me as being, you know, based in stereotypes of who owns the game, who's, you know, who's the intruder here versus who is, you know, rightfully there. And that was really hard to listen to and to watch. And it's even more frustrating now because, you know, the Cameroon Federation, they're sensitive to this. They see all this criticism. And they're now talking about, you know, disciplining their players as well and sanctioning the players. And this is a federation that barely invests anything in women's football as is. So now, you know, the Western media is, you know, dictating that conversation as well. And that's, whew, that's a lot to take in.
That's Lindsay Gibbs of Think Progress, and I'm Dan Friedel, filling in for Sonny Young on the Sunny Side of Sports. We'll hear more of my conversation with Lindsay later in the week. Now let's turn to the NBA. On Monday night, the league announced the winner of a number of awards. Giannis Antetokounmpo, born in Greece to Nigerian parents, won the league's Most Valuable Player Award, just ahead of Houston's James Harden. Rookie of the Year went to Dallas's Luka Doncic, who finished ahead of Atlanta's Trae Young. Pascal Siakam of the champion Raptors and Cameroon won the league's Most Improved Player Award. Rudy Gobert of France was the Defensive Player of the Year. And Magic Johnson and Larry Bird combined to win the league's Lifetime Achievement Award. We're joined now by Ben Golliver of the Washington Post to wrap up the NBA season and put some context around these awards. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, we just got some news about the NBA offseason, and we'll get to that in a minute. But it's good to take a chance to wrap up what we saw starting back in October and finishing off in the middle part of June. First off, a lot of the athletes coming into the awards ceremony on Monday were talking about the influence of international players in the NBA. We've got four major awards won by players who didn't grow up in the U.S. So have we reached peak penetration of the NBA by international players?
Well, we've definitely reached a high point. I think it's still going to go. I think the other big international story, of course, is that the Toronto Raptors, you know, the NBA's only Canadian team, wind up winning their first title ever. So it is sort of a celebratory time for the league's globalization. I mean, this is part of a, 20 to 30 year concerted effort to spread the game to developing countries and to, generate interest in a sport that really can be played by everybody. I'm not sure everybody knows this, but the person who invented basketball was actually a Canadian, James Naismith, and his idea was basically, I want to have a sport that, anybody can play, at any time of the year, whether it's cold outside, it's an indoor sport to kind of, prevent them from the, getting, touched by the elements. But it was a sport that could be played on any, basically any player. And I think some of the names you mentioned, Giannis Antetokounmpo from Milwaukee and Pascal Siakam, they're perfect examples of that. Giannis comes to the sport pretty late, by at least NBA standards. But his improvement has been so overwhelming that he winds up climbing all the way to the top of the mountain in just his sixth season to win his first MVP award. It's just an incredible accomplishment.
So, Ben, in your story in the Washington Post, you mentioned that before coming to the U.S., Giannis had never had a smoothie. So, some of the people in our audience might actually not know what a smoothie is. It's a refreshing drink made from blended fruit, maybe frozen yogurt, ice, and a little protein added in, especially if you're a high-level athlete. I also at one point heard that he had never eaten shrimp before his rookie year with the Bucks, and now here he's one of the most dominant players in the NBA. So, are there even enough words to describe his development?
It's fascinating because not only did he really have to learn English when he came to the NBA, he also had to learn all the basketball vernacular, too. So you think about the level of cultural knowledge he's taking in, all the off-court stuff that you're mentioning in terms of, food that he's able to eat, how the, American society works and all of that. But also on top of that, it's like going and getting a PhD in basketball, trying to catch up, on all the terminology and all the schemes and all the technical aspects of the sport. And then on top of that, you're dealing with the media who are asking you questions every single day in a language that is not your first language. So the fact that he was able to come, and when he was drafted, he was described as the most mysterious prospect in the draft. He was not seen as somebody who would be an immediate impact player. He was someone that you really needed to devote a lot of resources to in terms of teaching him the game and getting him up to speed. But he did have the phenomenal physical characteristics. What Giannis has been able to do, he has these long strides where he's able to cover ground much more quickly than a lot of players. He's really put on a lot of muscle and strength, and he's been able to overwhelm people physically. But he's also really learned and fashioned himself into one of the smartest players in the game. And you look at their offense, it was the third best offense in the entire league this year. He was the main reason why. Basically, everything started with him. He would drive into the paint, force all the defenders to come towards him, and then he would make some really tough choices about where you pass the basketball to find the open man. And he learned how to do that stuff over the course of his six-year NBA career. He was not coming to the NBA with that kind of knowledge base. So the improvement level for Giannis has really come on all sorts of different fronts, not only getting more comfortable with the American culture like you're talking about, but also settling into a league where, most NBA players, especially if they're coming from America, they're almost being prepped to be NBA players by the age of 12 or 13 with some of these feeder programs. And Giannis was certainly at a disadvantage in terms of when he started getting serious about basketball. But, boy, has he made up the time.
So, Ben, how about Cameroon's Pascal Siakam? For example, before this year's playoffs, he was basically unknown, playing in Canada, not being a heavily hyped prospect coming out of college. And during the Raptors' win over the Bucks in the Eastern Conference Finals, it could be argued he was the best or the second best player on the floor at some of the times. He's moved on from being a developmental player to a rising star. How much better can he get?
He can be an all-star player. I think his story is fascinating because it kind of shows you what happens when you get some true diversity within the management ranks. The Raptors president is Masai Ujiri. He's Nigerian. And, he has been a huge advocate of the Basketball Without Borders camps in Africa, which basically have turned into some of these development areas that NBA teams are able to find players who could potentially play in the NBA one day. That's sort of the route that Pascal Siakam took. And another player, Joel Embiid, for the Sixers has sort of been involved in that as well. Now, I think that, some executives, when they see a player who, like Siakam, maybe, not the most developed player right when he's being drafted, they would be afraid to take him because they'd be worried about their job. It would be a situation where, like, if this guy doesn't pan out, the owner's going to look over your neck and say, wait a minute, why did you take this guy over this other player who worked out masterfully? I think with Masai Ujiri, he's become such a respected executive that when he makes a pick, a player like Pascal Siakam, you know, ownership doesn't even blink twice, and he winds up being very invested in that player's development. Because they obviously have a personal connection.
That's some great analysis. We're big fans of Ujiri here on the show. We really appreciate your time. And that's all the time we have on this June 26th edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how long can a head of state maintain effective leadership? Some African leaders are forced out of office, while others respect the political process. The politics of transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
This is Science in a Minute.
Research over the past few years has provided evidence that music education can help a child's brain to grow and to mature quickly. A new study by researchers at Canada's University of Manitoba suggests students enrolled in high school music courses, regardless of factors such as their socioeconomic background or ethnicity, scored higher in math, science, and English exams than students not involved with music education. The study proposes that children who were taught to play a musical instrument in primary school and continued to play in secondary school were also found to be one academic year ahead of their non-musical colleagues in math, science, and English skills. The study authors found that students studying instrumental music did better academically than those who studied vocal music. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.